it's been a quiet week in Lake Wobegon, Minnesota, my hometown, out on the edge of the prairie. It's been raining and chilly out there, a little bit of snow now and then. It's that time of year that I remember from when I was a kid, when my uncles who were farming had a lot of extra time. You couldn't get into the fields quite yet, and so you sat around and you enjoyed their company. They did what they could, and then they came into the Chatterbox Cafe, and they sat, and they talked, and they talked, and they talked. This whole cadence of conversation that I remember of farmers. Sometimes they'd go visit each other, and they would squat on their heels. Three, four men sit there, and I was a kid, and they let me squat there with them. And they'd have a stick, and they'd trace little figures in the dirt, and they would talk, slow talk, long pauses in between. And yeah, old man Watson, he died. I heard that. He'd gone down to live with his daughter down in Minneapolis, but he dies. 86 years old. Good long life. Never had to go to a retirement home. I told the wife, I said, before you put me in a retirement home, I want you just to take a rifle, take me out and shoot me, that's all. That's what I'd like you to do. Well, they thought about that for a while. And then one of them said, well, don't ask her to do it. She's not going to do it. You want it done, ask me. I'll do it. Just tell me when. Tell me when you want it. But I'm going to need some money for that because I might have to spend some time up in Canada afterward. Well, they thought about that for a while, and they spit in the dirt, and they moved the dirt around with their stick. Yeah, my grandfather, he came down from Canada. He was a sailor up there in Halifax. He came down to visit and to help out his brother-in-law, and he was out in the hayfield, and he stepped in a gopher hole, and he broke his ankle, and he broke it badly, and then he tried to set it himself, and he didn't get it set right, and so he had a limp, and he couldn't be a sailor anymore, and so he had to go to work as a bartender. That was his fate. And he took up drink as well. No, that was a bad trip for my grandfather. They think about this. Gentle conversation. Yeah, I told the old lady, I said, before I die, I want to take up gin again. Speaking of bars. I had some when I was 18, and it just knocked me right off the bar stool. And I'd like to try it again. I don't think it would knock me off the bar stool now because I'm 100 pounds heavier. Speaking of 100 pounds, you remember those sacks of potatoes that we used to carry on our shoulders? We'd carry one on the left and one on the right. Just toss them around. Toss them into the back of a truck. Couldn't do that anymore. No, I don't think. Not with a wonderful sort of gentle conversation. Nobody holding court. Nobody trying to sell anybody anything. No politics. No religion. Just men talking sentences. That's all. I'm not sure anybody does that anymore. Except I just did, so I suppose that one could. Anyway, we had some rain. All the ice is off the lake now, and the loons have started to arrive. There seem to be three couples out there now. We hear them. They're going into their courting period pretty soon. It became the state bird in Minnesota about 50 years ago. Legislature had a debate on that. They knew that we'd be the butt of jokes with the loon as a state bird. Among the ignorant, we would be a joke, but who cares if the ignorant make fun of you, because anybody who's ever been around loons in the wild knows that haunting, beautiful cry and knows that they are monogamous, and except during their nesting period, they're a very amiable bird and they welcome other loons and they get together and they sing. You can hear them sometimes late at night. If the stars are very bright, you can hear them singing in harmony. It's that time of year. We listen to the loons and we remember our uncles and we think about our gardens. People have started their tomato plants in the basement under grow lights and started their onions as well. I did a little bit of gardening back when I was your age, and I was in my 20s, and I decided to be a writer. Not that I had a big choice about this, because I grew up among the sanctified brethren, and when you are brought up by people who teach you to avoid the unwashed and the unsaved and those who hold false doctrine, Methodists, Lutherans, and so forth, when you avoid the unsaved, then you do not develop social skills whatsoever. And so you are unfit for any job that requires you to come in contact with other people, and unfit for teaching or carpentry or, you know, auto mechanic, any of these things. Your options are very, very limited. You either become a writer or a lion tamer or a lighthouse keeper, one of those things. I became a writer, and through no mistake of my own, I made the right decision. At the very beginning, the way to start out as a writer, if you're serious about it, is to reduce your cost of living as far as you possibly can. And I found somebody who owned an abandoned farmhouse who was glad to have somebody live in it rent-free, and he was willing to pay for the fuel oil. And it came with a quarter acre of garden, and so I became a gardener, and I put in tomatoes, and I put in onions, potatoes, and corn and squash, and that's what I lived on for a while. And then he paid me to feed his hogs, which was not difficult work, and then he paid me some more to run his manure spreader, which I was very good at, I must say. Skill I may have to go back to someday. I don't know. No, I sat in that house with an Underwood typewriter, and I wrote. And of course, it's terribly discouraging. I suppose other occupations are as well. But writing, you work for weeks on something, and one day you look at it, and you think to yourself, "I am wasting my life. This is worth nothing. I'm sitting here wasting my life." And then you go back and work some more on it, and you waste more of your life. But you go out into your garden, and you look at your garden, and here you have created something real, small but real. These are real tomatoes. And you pick a ripe tomato that you grew yourself, and you bite into it through the skin, and all of this juice and all of this pride of this tomato. Every tomato believes in its core that it is the only tomato on earth. And you can taste that, and it restores your faith in the beauty of common things. And you go back into the house and you work some more. You work yourself into a hole month after month after month, and you try to be smarter than you actually are. And then you wind up writing sentences, just carving sentences and taking them apart and putting them back together. And eventually you may realize that what you are doing is recreating the conversation of your uncles as they sat squatting on their heels, rubbing a stick in the dirt. You are simply writing to that same cadence. So the ice is off the lake. Ice is off the lake. And it was the Sunday after Easter. The text for Pastor Liz was the passage in which Thomas, who doubted the resurrection, meets the Lord. Wonderful passage of Scripture. Tuesday, this last week, Marv, the driving instructor up at the high school, started giving behind-the-wheel instruction again. He hasn't, of course, all winter. It'd be dangerous to do that. So he's been forced to be a substitute teacher all winter, which is terrible work. You get a phone call in the morning and you go off to somebody's class and you teach children something you have no idea what it is yourself. And there's a lot of smirking and a lot of eye rolling, and they give you the jobs that nobody else wants, and suddenly you become the girls' field hockey coach, and you become the advisor to the junior senior prom, and they want the theme to be Mozambique, whatever that may mean, and they want to have a big band, and they have the big ideas, and you're the one who has to make them happen, and then they make you direct the play, the senior class play, which is The Crucible. A play you've hated ever since you were in high school, and you had to see your girlfriend in it being a witch. And no, The Crucible. And so you have to direct this play, and then you have to teach classroom driver's training, and finally you've got to be behind the wheel, and you put that big sign on the rear bumper of the car, student driver. And he took off noon on Tuesday with Tracy Halverson, who's the daughter of the superintendent. So he was a little nervous on that account. He does take Enderol when he does behind the wheel, just to calm things down there. So you don't find yourself stomping on the floorboard there on the right-hand side looking for a break, and you don't shriek, you know, or do unmanly things. He took an Enderol, and Tracy got behind the wheel, and she had never driven a stick shift before, and she revved it up, and she let out the clutch, and whoa, it leaped forward, and he took another Enderol, and they went out into the country, and they worked on left-hand turns for a while, and then they were about to come back into town and work on parallel parking. And then he awoke. He had felt very relaxed, and now he awoke, and they were nowhere near here. The car was parked in a ball field, and there was an enormous blue canvas tent being put up by a crew of men, and there was an elephant standing there, and the men were erecting banners with a picture of a Lipizzaner horse and a trapeze artist and a gorilla and a juggler and clowns. And there were all these RVs around and smaller tents, and Tracy was not there. She had left. He had no idea. He couldn't remember what had happened. He had his cell phone, and he looked at GPS, and they were in a town called Lisbon. He never heard of a Lisbon, Minnesota. But here they were. He looked down a street, and here was a tavern, and there was a church steeple. And he couldn't think of what had brought them here. He got behind the wheel, and he drove over toward the men who were putting up the tent. And then it came back to him. She is in the crucible. And she plays Abigail. And she has this line that has echoed in his mind. John Proctor took me from my sleep and put knowledge in my heart. John Proctor loved me, and whatever sin it was, you love me still. And he got this chill feeling that he had done something wrong and that he was in trouble. He felt guilty, but he didn't know for what. He drove over to the men and he said, "Have you seen a young woman, blonde hair and a blue denim jumper and a red?" And then he saw that they didn't understand English at all. And he didn't know where to go. And then he felt this strong, hairy arm behind his head reaching around. And he went to push it away, and he could not. It was the elephant's trunk. It had come in through his open window, and it was looking for a box of McDonald's French fries on the dashboard. Where did that come from? It scarfed them all up. It was wheezing and puffing, and mucus was dripping on his shirt. And now the car started to rise up a couple of feet in the air, and he dove out the open window, out onto the grass, and he ran away from the car. And then here, two blocks away, came Tracy Halverson toward him, and she was sobbing, walking towards him. And he thought, "My God, I passed out, and I tried to put my arms around her. And now I'm going to be fired, and they're going to take away my pension, and I won't be able to retire in a year, and Louise is going to leave me, and I'm going to have to go live with my brother or something." And it just all happened. I had no idea. He walked towards Tracy, who was sobbing, and she walked up, and she put her arms up. No. No. What's wrong? What's wrong, darling?" He shouldn't have called her darling. He should not have called her darling. She said, "I'm so sorry, Mr. Johnson. I thought I was going in the right direction, and you fell asleep, and I didn't want to wake you up, and I just kept driving, and I have no idea where we are. I'm so sorry." He was just about to say, "Darling, my judgment was impaired. I was on this powerful drug, and I'm so sorry. Please, please have mercy on—" And he did not have to say that. She got back in the car. He drove. He was a little woozy. The lady on the GPS on his phone told him which way to go. He was grateful for that. He had no idea where he was. He headed towards Lake Wobegon. She had her script with her in the car, the crucible. He said, "How are you coming on that?" She said, "I still have to learn my lines." And she said, "John Proctor took me from my sleep, and he put knowledge in my heart. You loved me, whatever sin it was, and you loved—" No. Don't. Please, don't do that now. No. They came into Lake Wobegon, and there was the sign that said, "Lake Wobegon, gateway to central Minnesota." They came in through, past the great concrete silos and the grain elevator, and he pulled over, and he said, "Tracy," he said, "nobody's going to believe us if we tell them about Lisbon and the elephant and the circus. Nobody's going to believe us, so we have to make up a story. And I know it's not right, but we have to agree on this. There was a flat tire. It was the right rear tire. Can you remember that? The right rear tire. And the spare was flat too. And I had to walk a long way into town. And that's what happened. Okay? Can you remember that?" "Okay," she said, "but I'm really sorry. I'm really sorry." They drove into town. His heart was pounding. He took the student driver sign off the rear bumper and he parked his car, and into school they went. There was a smell of lilacs in the air. Not the smell he wanted at that particular moment. Lilacs, sweet lilacs. He tried not to look at her. He hoped that this would all disappear and that nobody would ever find out. How did I find out? That's for me to know. That's the news from Lake Wobegon, where all the women are strong, all the men are good looking, all the children are above average.